My name's Jeff Hocking. I'm a graphic designer, and I studied at what was once called the Bendigo School of Mines. It's became the Bendigo College of Advanced Education, and I studied what was then known as Diploma of Advertising Art. But while I was in my final year at art school, for some strange reason, I designed quite a number of album covers in my folio, and I was very interested in printmaking, and I did a number of lino cuts. They weren't for pop music, but they were for general recorded sound. Or I did one thing which was a poem, a recording that was done by Richard Burton at the time, and I did a lino cut for that. That was the Rime of the Ancient Mariner.
Right, good.
And I must admit, that's probably that one piece of work that got me a job at World Record Club, because they were really into lino cuts for album cover art at the time. But there were only two places I really fancied working. One was World Record Club and the other was the ABC, which both of them had studios that were really there for making art for pleasure. It wasn't commercial. It gave you a good opportunity to be an illustrator or an artist, but your work was either put up on the screen or put onto an album cover, and you got paid for it, which was preferable to being a painter and trying to survive. But I left art school. I was 18 years old, and I drove down to Melbourne, and I went around all the agencies and the various studios, and had little luck getting a job. This is 1967 or 8 or something like that. And I went out to World Record Club with my folio, and they were impressed because I had lots of drawings and sketches and various things, plus the record covers. And nearly everything I had was illustrated, lots of hand lettering, and it was the sort of thing that they were doing at the time. But they didn't have a job, but they did give me my first ever freelance job. They asked me if I wanted to do artwork for an album cover, and I was thrilled to do that and had no idea what to do next. casting off type for the back of the album was something that we actually hadn't learnt at school, and I had to actually count up every letter on the typewritten sheet, then find something that was the right type size I wanted to use and count out the number of letters, and that way I could figure out how much room the type would take on the back of the album cover. Because everything was set in hot metal those days, so,
yes.
And printed World Record Club printed letterpress. Everything was made into zinc blocks and plates, and it was a very expensive process.
Let's just go back a step and talk a little bit more about, I guess, the role that World Record Club occupied at that time. I imagine it was probably quite well known amongst designers for that work. But what about more generally? Because these days it is one of those slightly esoteric things which seems to only exist as secondhand records in op shops. But at the time, obviously, it was a very different beast.
Well, the World Record Club came into Australia at a time when the LP was just coming onto the market. This is 1958, which, when you think about it, it's only a decade since the end of the Second World War. And there was a great period of prosperity, and people, people like return servicemen were in their 40s, and they generally had good jobs and setting up families, and then some disposable income, and people were looking for other ways of entertaining themselves or amusing themselves or educating themselves. And the LP was just starting to make its way into common use. And really the thing that brought about the great sales of the vinyl LP was the introduction of a decent hi-fi playback machine at a reasonable cost. And it's pretty hard to imagine today that people really still didn't have record players, even at the end of the 50s and getting into the 60s. And so when you're able to buy an LP playing machine and buy that at reasonable cost, suddenly there's a boom in sales of the recorded music. And World Record actually started in England, and the man, he was an Australian, and a number of other Australians who went to England at the same time, they'd worked for Coloured Review, which was where they printed Australasian Post at the time, and lots of books were being created by Herald, the Herald Sun, and Coloured Review. But young Rupert Murdoch took over and a lot of people left, and they all went to work together in England. Well, this is where World Record Club started. The boss actually met up with a record producer and a number of other people, and they could see lots of recorded music coming out of Eastern Europe and Germany and places like that, which were really not getting distribution in the UK. But it's a bit like Naxos today, where they were finding new orchestras or Eastern Bloc orchestras and young, unheard-of musicians like Yehudi Menuhin and Daniel Barenboim and people like that were really just coming onto the scene. So they were started buying the recorded music and decided to release them via direct mail. That is, you joined a club and you pre-ordered all your records, and then every month you got a delivery of the ones that you recorded. And they put out two catalogues a year, so you could order an entire year's buying in advance. One of the beauties of that for World Record Club is they knew how many records they'd sold. So if the catalogue went out in December and the May orders would have already come in, they would know that they'd sold 5,000 of this recording or 200 of that recording. And it, often the record cover design matched the sales. So things like Gilbert and Sullivan always had, and all the shows, My Fair Lady and Mikado and all of those things, really had very strong sales at the time. And so they got full colour covers.
Right.
Other things which were a bit more esoteric sometimes only got a single colour cover. And we had to be pretty clever at making all of those things look equal.
It's sort of like a fascinating way to work, isn't it? It's almost like working in reverse, whereas these days, you know, the cover is very much, I guess, an integral part of selling the product. And in the case of a lot of recorded music, of course, it's, you know, intimately tied up with the image of the band or all those sorts of things. But in this case, you're really just providing, I guess, another aspect to something which, I don't know, people are perhaps not buying because of the cover, or that's something which is a bit of an added extra, really, isn't it?
It was really an added extra, but it got to the point where World Record Club covers were so creative that they became an integral part of the recording. I've spoken to people who say they remember the music by what was on the cover, and they certainly, I mean, World Record had 60,000 members in Australia, so there's a lot of buyers of our material, and so a lot of people have fond memories of those packages arriving and then getting a surprise at what was on the cover, because we hadn't designed the covers before the catalogues went out. So people got a pleasant surprise. The other thing is that there were three or four journalists working full-time at World Record Club writing the liner notes and so on. And what happened, people got a musical education from the back covers.
Right, yes.
I mean, at the time, in the 50s and 60s, if you had an old 78 player and you bought a Beethoven symphony, you'd have to change it 15 times to listen to one piece of music. Here, you only had to flip the record once. And so people, by and large, did not know much about classical music. They knew the Russians, like Rimsky-Korsakov and so on, and Tchaikovsky, because they'd been picked up by Disney and they appeared in Fantasia, Mussorgsky, Night on Bald Mountain and all that sort of stuff was all played and became background for a lot of Disney things. So people actually had a reasonable knowledge about the big names, but they didn't know anything about Wagner, and they'd never heard of Handel or Haydn or Vivaldi. I mean, it's hard to believe that Vivaldi would have been largely unplayed until World Record Club started releasing these things in the 60s.
So it was really the beginning, yes, as you say, of spreading a lot of that music around the country and widening people's, I guess, understanding and appreciation of it.
Well, certainly the beginning of the understanding of the Baroque. I mean, people like Bach and so on. I mean, people would have known Handel's Messiah because that's a big popular piece of choral music, but the rest of the Handel oeuvre would have been largely unheard. So what World Record Club did was that it brought to Australia a sense of European musical history. We were a part of that. I mean, what we had to do was interpret the music visually. Quite often, we would have just taken a guess because you didn't get to hear the music, but after a short while, you certainly learnt what period graphic worked with a particular period of music. And I mean, I was 19 years old by this time, and I'd learnt so much about music. Oh, and I was into jazz, so I really didn't know Bach or Beethoven. But by the end of my time there, I was very well-rounded. Classical music, not expert, but I really had a great understanding. In fact, I read the liner notes so much that I wrote somewhere recently that I could tell where I was when I travelled in Europe in the late 60s by the opera houses. You know, I knew where all the great opera houses were, and I knew the names of all the great castles because we'd done designs for music that had been recorded there.
That's fantastic.
I was lost if we hadn't done a World Record Club cover for it.
That's interesting that you mentioned your love of jazz there, because I guess the other great iconic sleeve, of course, which would be from this period, would be the Blue Note sleeves.
Oh, yes.
Was that something that you were aware of? Did that feed into?
Certainly. I was young and silly enough to import those albums for myself. I'd go down to Thomas's and order stuff, which would come from America, and Limelight with those fabulous fold-out covers. They had pop-up covers.
Right.
They were the first gatefolds with, like, when you think of Sgt. Pepper's was really the first pop gatefold.
Mm.
Limelight were doing those with pop-ups and books glued in and all sorts of things. They're really extravagant covers. So when I was buying those in the mid-60s, and I must admit that I started doing a lot of folded paper stuff, and then photographing it in a way, emulating what those American covers were doing.
Mm. Just give us more of an idea of how it did. Typically, what went into a cover then? You mentioned that you might not have actually heard the music before you had to design it. So, what were you told? What were you given? And how did you start?
Well, the journalists who worked there were great music writers. I mean, they had incredible knowledge about the music themselves. They'd all been involved either in the recording industry or managed orchestras overseas or one thing or another. And they would come in and tell us what their vision was. I mean, we had some fantastic arguments, went through the studio amongst the artists, designers, and everyone put in their two bobs worth. And quite often you would take they would come in and say, this is Beethoven's Eroica. Eroica is about Napoleon, right? So that's all you needed.
Mm.
And this piece of music may have been released three or four times before, so you were able to see what was done by others. And you had to then go away and think, well, what is a new way to interpret this? Sometimes you would do a drawing, or you might find an old engraving of the period, or yet another portrait of Beethoven. But you got that information from the writer of the liner notes. And there was one argument at one stage I remember where, and I've forgotten what the piece of music was now, but one of the staff designers had an exhibition of his own collages, and they were just scraps of paper glued down, and they're really abstract pieces, but there was one hanging in the studio, and a number of designs had been done for a particular cover, and Harvey Blanks at the time, who was senior writer, came in and pointed to this abstract and said, that's the perfect artwork for that cover. And everyone else looked and thought, oh, we'd never thought of that. That's it. That's what I want. So that was then just photographed and put on the cover.
Mm.
And I remember we were doing Peter Sculthorpe's Sun Music, the first recording of his classic work, and we tootled off down to the Australian Galleries in the Boss's Rover at lunchtime to look for an appropriate piece of Australian artwork to go on this very important recording. And we walked around the Australian Galleries and we looked at a number of famous names, and this is the 60s, so they were just beginning to be really well known.
Hmm.
And we settled upon a lovely little Albert Tucker. And so we bought that. It was £150, I think.
Hmm.
And we whacked this little Tucker in the back of the Rover and drove back to the studio, had it photographed, and that became the cover artwork for the first recording of Sculthorpe's Sun Music. Now, that painting hung in the Boss's office for the next 10 years. Who knows where it is now? But I was told that when the company was eventually sold to EMI, the accountants from EMI came through the offices and were horrified at the collection of Australian artwork. And they went and sold it all back to the gallery. And we had a terrific collection of some really quite important names, which we'd all used or used them all on album covers from one time or another. I mean, Charles Blackman and Tucker and Robert Juniper and Barbara Brash and we'd used John Olsen's and Roger Kemp's. So, I mean, it's quite a list of quite well-known Australian artists.
Which is probably also, in a lot of ways, putting the art out there that would otherwise never have been seen either, or would have just remained fairly obscure.
Well, I think we're performing a very important cultural service. And I mean, we loved it, going down to the gallery and buying artwork, you know, and just carting it off in the back of a car like a bag of shopping. And
yes. So what was the philosophy behind having to design all the covers locally? Because I'm sure that in some cases records would have been released, or the recordings would have already been released elsewhere with cover art. Why was the decision made to not use that and to go with something
new? I'm not entirely sure why, but it was a very clever thing to do. It said this was an Australian product, and I think, I don't know. I don't know whether it was economic, because it certainly wasn't cheaper. You could have bought film from overseas but it would have just been the same product. It just looked the same as anything else you probably could have imported. So, and the man who set up the studio, Jeff Digby, who'd gone from Colour Graveur in Australia to work with the team at National Magazine, a similar kind of operation in Britain, when he came back, the decision was just taken then to originate all that artwork. And there were enough young designers then who were desperate to do some creative stuff. At that time, the only real job opportunities for graphics designers was either advertising agencies or printers or the ABC. Mm. And printers were just doing commercial jobbing work. There were the Australian book industry was almost non-existent. I mean, everything came from Britain or America, mostly Britain. Children's books hardly existed. You had Snuggle Pot and Cuddle Pie, and but what you've got today is an enormous industry that didn't exist at all at the time. So the opportunities for creative and expressive work were very narrow. When World Record Club decided to use, you know, fresh, young Australian talent, there were just scores of people anxious to do some creative work. So that's where you got the terrific work. Mm. People were coming out of the agencies to do a freelance job for World Record. Every student wanted to do, you know, a World Record Club cover. Every student had one at least in their folio at some stage. I mean, I had about five, so so when I got there, I was ready and well primed.
I mean, it's fascinating to hear this and to I guess learn about what a desirable thing it was, and how highly prized the, you know, these jobs were and these covers were. When you think now that they are just, you know, very much the unfortunately in some ways, or fortunately, I don't know, things that, as I mentioned earlier, occupy, you know, bargain basement bins at art shops. I mean,
that's why I did the book, because I was in Dalesford at the book barn and in the bookshop in the main street of town, and they have a big collection of second-hand records out the back, and I do this when I go to street markets too. I flip through the records to see how much of my folio is now out for a dollar. and I started making a little pile of records, going, oh, that's so-and-so's album, and that's so-and-so's, and various friends or colleagues, I knew their artwork, and I started making a pile, thinking, I think I might do something with these. Mm. When my wife came back in, she saw the pile and said, what on earth are you going to do with all those? And I had $300 worth. And I said, oh, I'm just going to just collect them for some reason or other. And then it just started. Every time we went out, I would rifle through the dump bins and pull out the World Record Club product. I put out an email at the trade one day saying, does anyone have any old records? And quite a number of people contacted me immediately saying, oh, I've got a box out in the shed and so on. And then they would contact their parents, who would have a box in the shed. So gradually I built up the collection. I've got 500 album covers in the book. At the moment, there's an exhibition of that up at La Trobe's Gallery in View Street, Bendigo. There's 100 on the wall, and that looks like a huge amount. Mm. The company did anywhere between 2,000 and 3,000, and no one really knows the actual number. We certainly know it's more than 2,000. So the 500 I've got in my book, is less than a quarter of the total output.
What was there? Yeah.
Could be a sixth of the total output. And I've been coming across on various internet sites, World Record Club covers that I've never seen before. I look at them and I can tell who did them by the style, but they just didn't appear anywhere in anybody else's collections who sent them to me. So there is a huge amount of really exciting graphic work out there that in many ways has just disappeared.
Yeah, but it is a great story, and it's great to have it told and remembered in this way as well. And hopefully it will sort of make people a bit more appreciative, perhaps, of what is, I guess, unfortunately seen perhaps in some ways as a bit of a throwaway product these days, but they're really not. They're really sort of, as you're highlighting here, fantastic artworks which should be sought out and appreciated for that as well, just as much as, of course, as for the music contained within.
Well, that's right. And they look nice in frames, too. I've framed a few of my favourites up. But when you're looking through dump bins, you don't find many at the markets. Mostly you find at the markets Perry Como and Trini Lopez and Harry Secombe, which have all got appalling covers.
And always the Rex Harrison version of My Fair Lady. That's everywhere.
With the white cover and the black line drawing.
That's right, yes.
That's a CBS recording. That
one. Yes. And the sort of pink and gold lettering.
Oh, isn't that lovely? Yes.
It's a nice cover, but it's everywhere, you know.
Everyone hates it today.
Jeff, thank you very much for all your time this morning. It's been very generous of you and great to hear some of the story. Thanks again.
A pleasure, Jeremy.